Would you pray with me? Lord, once again, I ask you that the words of my mouth and the meditations of each of our hearts would be acceptable in your sight, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Well, I was thinking this week about this issue of inclusivity, and I was thinking about this story and what we see Jesus doing, and I was thinking about us, thinking about our lives. I was recalling the elementary school days. Do you remember recess and do you remember picking teams? You'd go outside and you'd go, you know, play soccer, play softball, play whatever. And you remember like how you would pick teams? How many of you remember doing it with a baseball bat with the hands over the hands, right? And you get to the top and you could, if it was allowed, you could do fingertips, right, at the very top. Sometimes it wasn't. But whoever won that got to pick the team first, and then they would go, well, we want Norm, you know, we want Annabelle, we want Bill. And you'd sit there, right, while they were doing that, and you'd wait anxiously to see if whoever that was, the two guys that were picking, would call your name. Do you remember that anxiety, just kind of waiting to be chosen? And do you remember what it was like to be the last person chosen?
Yeah.
Yeah, lots of us do, I think. But I was really just reminded of that. I was also thinking about the classic, remember, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, you know, catch a tiger by the toe. Right? If you hollers, let him go. Other great way, there you go, right there. Another great way to pick who you would be having on your team. And all the time this was going on around you, if you weren't one of the pickers, if you were a picky, all the time this was going around, your inner spirit was screaming, me too, me too. I want to be on your team. And remember the hurt of not being chosen? Remember how that felt? Of being passed over? Of not being enough, good enough, fast enough, smart enough, able to hit the ball far enough. Whatever it was, there was something that wasn't enough about you and you got chosen pretty far down the line. Everybody's had that experience somewhere. Maybe it's not the baseball field. Maybe it's in art class. Maybe it's in music class. Maybe it's wherever. But wherever it was that your skills didn't really shine, you'd end up pretty far down that line and you'd wait. And everything in you would be going, come on, me too, me too. That feeling of not being something enough. Well, Jesus has come to tell us that we're enough. And I want to talk about that today. One of the most dramatic places, I think, that we see this is in Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. This issue of not being enough, of not being included. Here's a little bit of the text right here. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Inclusivity, screaming for inclusivity, an entire people screaming for inclusivity, still screaming as it were. Or how about this one? Here's another one. Passing someone you once knew and having them look away like they don't see you coming, like they don't recognize you anymore. We've probably all had that experience somewhere. We all know about that pain of being ignored, overlooked, not having your essential humanness acknowledged is one of the deepest rejections and greatest pains that we can suffer. That's why I've talked about this before. I absolutely love this. In the movie Out of Africa, if you remember that, it takes place amidst this tribe known as the Kikuyu. And the archetypal Kikuyu greeting was, I see you. I see you. Linda, I see you. I see you. Sandra, I see you. That recognition of humanity. Ron, I see you. I'm not overlooking you. I don't miss you. I see you. I see who you are. I see how you are. Great greeting, I think. But we live in a dispassionate world that seeks to marginalize us, to tell us that we're not good enough, that we're insignificant, that we can't, in fact, be seen. And all the while, all that humanity within us is screaming out, me too, me too. See me. As a pastor and a counselor, I can tell you self-esteem issues are huge. I spent 2 days this week, 2 8-hour days, in a seminar. And it's a peacemaking seminar. It's a conciliation seminar, training us to be conciliators. It's called transformative skills. And conciliation amongst people is indeed a transformative skill, because when you are reconciling people, you are transforming them. And it was marvelous. It was really a full and wonderful experience. And we recognize one another, I think, in stages. If you think about it, I think recognition manifests itself in stages. First, there's nodding to someone. Maybe you don't know them, maybe you don't know their name, but you pass them out here in the narthex or outside in a safe way, and you nod to them. Yeah, I see you, kind of thing. And the next one is speaking to them. Hi, Phil, how are you? Then there's meeting with them. Can we sit down and talk for a minute? I'd really be interested in getting to know you a little bit, Bonnie. Something like that. And then there's the intimacy of sharing a meal. That breaking bread issue that's so big, biblical, that breaking bread issue that we're going to share here in just a little bit. That's a me too thing. The development of these relationships is life-changing. We all know that. One of the great things about being pastor here is to watch as new snowbirds come in the winter, or new folks come and move here, and they hesitantly come in here among us, and they see something that appeals to them. Maybe it's the music. Maybe it's the sanctuary itself. Certainly not the sermon. And they become slowly drawn in. They take that first step and they show up for something. They come and help at the rummage sale, or they come volunteer in the office or what have you. And it's so nice to watch relationships start to build. And you see them become real and active in the life of the church. And you see the energy it brings to people. Gosh, I love that. So we see that sort of thing in our story this morning. We meet a tax collector named Levi. Now, it's a little hard for us to understand just how this Levi is, just where he fits into the structure of his society, because we're a couple thousand years removed from this, and we're a lot of culture removed from it. So I want to kind of help us with that a little bit. You see, taxes were the raison d'etre of the Roman Empire. It's how they fueled the machine. They would overcome nations, and they were very good. Unlike the Babylonians and the Assyrians who preceded them, the method of conquest for those earlier nations was to go to a nation, conquer them, and take their people and dislocate them and take them to another nation where they weren't at home, where they were unsettled. That's how they did it. But the Romans, they were brilliant. They would come and take over an area, and they said, no, you're fine. Y'all just stay where you are. What we want from you is your taxes. And they would collect them. The taxes were the oil which lubricated this massive machine, this imperial machine. The Roman system of taxation, though, depended on graft and greed, and it attracted enterprising individuals who were not averse to such means. Here's what I'm talking about. You see, in Century 1 Palestine, the Roman government contracted with locals, because the locals knew where everybody was. They knew who everybody was. They contracted with locals, most of whom were ethnic but not observant Jews in Israel. You see, Torah-abiding Jews could not be expected to transact business with Gentiles like the Romans. And so they would go to these non-observant Jews and they would select them as tax collectors. And it meant that the tax collectors were despised as traitors and collaborators. And in Jesus' time, a Jew who collected taxes was seen as both morally contemptuous and ritually unclean. They dwelt beyond the boundaries and the comforts of that Hebrew community. They were disqualified, for instance, as being judges in a trial. They were, in fact, disqualified as being witnesses in a trial. They were somehow seen as less than human. They were expelled from the synagogue. They were the cause of disgrace for their families. To have a son that was a tax collector was to have a son that ceased to exist. This makes this Levi, who we meet this morning, it makes him the bottom of the barrel. He's an outcast. He may be a wealthy outcast because of the graft that he could perpetuate from his position, but an outcast nonetheless. He's the last guy anybody would choose to play on their team. So while we might imagine this outcast Levi wanting to cry, "Me too," when the Messiah wanders by his tax station, we can't conceive any sort of real possibility of that happening for him. There's no way the Messiah would stop and speak with him. Certainly no way the Messiah would reach out a hand to him. The simplicity of Mark's text is stunning. Listen to it again. As Jesus was walking along, no big deal, right? As Jesus was walking along, he saw Levi, son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax booth. And he said to him, "Follow me." No preamble, no pretense, nothing leading up to this. He just walks by and says, "Follow me." And he got up and followed him. That's as stunning as Jesus' invitation. Levi gets up and leaves his tax station and follows this guy, this itinerant rabbi, this nobody from Nazareth. We're amazed that Jesus would pick a follower with such obvious personal deficiencies. But we're equally amazed that Levi just ups and goes, leaves behind his way of life, leaves behind his livelihood. There's no questions asked. What is it we have to see about this Jesus that can create such an immediate turnaround in a human life? There's a magnetism here that we just can barely imagine, but we see it evidenced in texts like this. Or how about Zacchaeus? Over and over again, Jesus walks by somebody, enters somebody's life, even marginally, and reaches out a hand to them, and bang, they follow him. There's something really magical there. We can almost hear, in this case, we can almost hear the crowd gasp at this event. "That's Levi. Why is he calling Levi?" But Jesus doesn't stop there. Jesus doesn't stop there. His offense rapidly metastasizes, as it were, when he heads off to Levi's house to break bread with many tax collectors and sinners. Oh, yes, and his disciples as well. What is that all about? Everybody must be looking at this going, "What's with this guy? What's he doing there?" Now, the English text, our text, says that Jesus sat at dinner. That's the best we have, right? But if you really read it in the original Greek, it says that he actually reclined at dinner. You see, this picture is pretty accurate. The tables were low, and there would be cushions spread all around, and the diners would be seated on the cushions, and they would be half reclining on the table like this. It was a scene of intimacy, and it was typical of the posture for feasts and celebrations. This is not a formal meal. This is a meal amongst people who are getting to know one another. There's no indication that Jesus preaches or lectures. You might expect that. Okay, so I've gathered these sinners and tax collectors around me. This is my time to really swing the bat at them. Let me straighten them out. Let me get them back on the straight and narrow. There's no indication that Jesus does anything like that. He apparently just enjoys and promotes the fellowship with these broken, fallen outcasts. It's not a formal event. It's just friends fully accepting of one another. Now, when the guardians of propriety raise issues about this, those Pharisees and Sadducees and judgmental type people, those holier than thous, Jesus responds, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I've come to call not the righteous, but the sinners." Let that sink in. Because I don't want to call any of you names, but that's really good news for most of us. This means that when we look to Jesus, and when we go, me too, Jesus looks back at us and he says, yes, yes, you. Yes, you. You, come. He accepts us. He hears our pain. He hears our desire to join him. This is the scandal of this story, you see, which is just as much ours as it is Levi's. Me too, we cry with all of our brokenness. And Jesus says, yes, 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 come eat with me. He places no conditions on his love or his acceptance. He loves and accepts us, tax collectors and sinners, though we may be. And if one of us calls to repent, it's not in order to gain Jesus' favor, but because Jesus has already dispensed his favor. He's already loved us and sought us out. It's our response to what he's already done. And this means that, in the words of the song, when the night is come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, Jesus is the one who stands by us. Isn't that great news? Welcome to the scandal of grace. Welcome to the scandal of grace. Reach out now and embrace it. Haven't earned it, don't deserve it. But it's here. Jesus' grace is large enough for everybody in this room and everybody on the other side of that camera. Me too. Me too. Jesus has said yes, you too, to each person here today, each person in this room, each person on the other side of that camera. He said yes, you. Yes, you. And now he seeks yet a greater intimacy with us. Having established that relationship, he wants more. Now, unimaginable as it seems, he calls us to share a meal with him. It's not the nod of the head. It's not those first words. It's not an introductory conversation. He wants to break bread with us, and he wants to host the meal. That's how much he loves us, each and every one of us. That's how deeply he accepts us, each and every one of us. But you see, this isn't just any meal. This is the meal in which we remember and we proclaim. And in our remembering and in our proclaiming, we become what we receive. Christ in you, the hope of glory, the apostle says. This is the meal in which Christ pulls us as praying participants into the life of the salvation of the entire world. He gives us a place, a role in that. This is the meal which spills over the plate and pours over the edge of the chalice in the sanctuary and into the living of our common lives. When the night has come and the land is dark, this is the meal which brings light. The table is set. The meal is ready. It's for everyone, no matter where or how you've been. There's a place card with each of your names on this table. All of you. Those of you out there as well, Jesus expects you. Jesus invites you. Here's the place cards. Peter, James, John, Andrew, Levi, Judas, Byron, Eileen, Bill. Each and every one of us has a place card at this table. This is a C.S. Lewis quote. Friendship is born at the moment when one person says to another, "What? You too? I thought I was the only one." What? You too? I thought I was the only one. It's all of us. That's the love of Jesus Christ. That's the love he asks us to share with one another. So come now and gather around this table of Christ's inviting. You don't have to fight for a spot. You don't have to elbow any out of the way. You don't have to clamor for attention. He sees you. He knows you. Oh, yeah. And he already chose you. There you go. So this is the time you can say it quietly. This is the time you can say it with relief. This is the time you can say it with thanksgiving. You can say this. You can say it with certainty. You can say, "Me too. Me too." Amen. Let us take a moment and listen in silence to what the Spirit may be saying to each of us.